and he and his friends made out on just about nothing except their own excitement and their own creativity and their own dreams. That was the most important part of all. They all had dreams. When one looks back now and reads of the people he was associated with, it's the who's who of talent of the first part of the 20th century. And I think how sterile so much of our life is today. You're in communication, and so am I. Yet what I wouldn't have given at that time, you know, it would have been just incredible.
But always the connecting link, because I
see to have been a member of the group, you know, to have been
a member of that group.
Been in that group, yes.
Just the group of Apollinaire and the group of the
ballet dancers,
the
poets,
ballet dancers,
novelists,
Diaghilev,
painters,
of course,
that's right,
and all those
that's
guys,
right.
And Bakst, and
yeah.
Delaunay, and
yeah,
the variety,
exactly.
And did he know Rousseau too, didn't he? I think he might have.
He gave him one of these great parties.
Did,
Rousseau
yeah.
was a somewhat ridiculed and overlooked customs agent, just exactly what his name
mm-hmm.
means, douanier.
Douanier.
And Picasso found a tremendous portrait of Rousseau's mother, which he bought for 5 francs in the flea market. It's now been given to the Louvre. And in total seriousness, I'm sure, Picasso threw a tremendous dinner in his broken down old studio in Montmartre around the turn of the century. Mm. And Rousseau was the guest of honor. He treated him with all the respect of a master. And the guy was a little guy painting alone at night back in his little flat back someplace in God knows where in Paris.
It's something Picasso knew and was looking for and seeking and as much as anyone discovered and fulfilled. It's also his connected, as in your book, through himself surrounded by things and thinking about things and his own paintings, they were connected with the whole history of the human race. The lights, he speaks of Vermeer lights. He speaks of Rembrandt, too. And so it says all form, all style, all history this one guy.
Yeah, you know, he went to the Art Academy in Madrid and graduated at 15. He took an examination at 15, which took most graduate painters 30 days to fulfill. He did it, knocked it off in one day. Then he went on to do his own thing. But in Paris, pressed by his own curiosity, he would spend many hours in the various museums around the city. Long before anybody else was paying much attention to African art, he picked it up, which became the root. I say it became, it might have become the root. I can never assign a flat statement to what caused Picasso's mind to work or his hands to paint, but became the root, I think, of the great Cubist period.
Just turned a page 15. It's a double page, a photograph of David Douglas Duncan of Picasso eating, and here's the fish bones, absolutely eaten clean. Now, something happened to those fish bones, didn't
they? Yeah, Studs, we were having luncheon, a normal day at the studio at his home, Cannes, and he's just polishing off a sole. But he left the skeleton absolutely intact. In the photograph, it looks like he's playing a harmonica, a very strange sort of harmonica. And I made one shot, one negative, that was it. And he left the table, went to the front of the house, came back with 3 or 4 slabs of fresh potter's clay. He placed the skeleton of the sole, the fish, upon the first slab of clay, covered it with a sheet of paper, and pressed down very hard with the palms of his hands and made an impression like you make a new fossil in the clay. And he did it 3 or 4 times. And then very carefully trimmed the shape of the slab of clay into the form of a fish fillet, placed those fillets with the impressions embedded in them as a fossil upon unfired plates, sent them up to his kilns in Valeries, fired them, painted them, and made a whole series of plates employing the skeleton of a fish he just had for lunch.
So a work of nature became a work of art.
Just great.
Yeah, a work of nature became art.
Yeah,
case,
sure. Yeah. Also his lunch.
And his lunch.
Sure.
3, 4 things.
You can't beat that.
So, also work. Picasso and work, you said, the hours. I think somewhere you've quoted him here. It's, if I can't work, I can't breathe.
That's right. Work is my respiration.
Until what age did he work?
To the last night of his life.
And that was?
It was on the he died on the 8th of April, 1973, last year.
How old?
91.
So
91
until the last?
91 and a half.
So he worked until the last night of his life.
Yep.
91.
Yep. Yep. You know, I still speak of him in the present tense. It's an astonishing thing. I don't accept the fact that he's not down the road from my house there in the south of France. Just working away at something. That was the excitement. I'd drive by at night and see all the lights on and say, what the heck is he doing now, you know? Because one could never tell.
But there again, and also, I suppose, the element of play. The kind of element of play. Here's Picasso. This was the cover of one of your earlier Picasso.
Yeah, similar to it.
With a mask. Then,
yeah, sure.
Derby hat, mask, clown.
Yeah. He was waiting for Cocteau to come, and Cocteau just had arrived, and he popped up in back of one of his big canvases to surprise him. But the element of play, it was... I thought about that a great deal, too. In a way, he was giving another dimension of himself to his guests. You know, he was very Spanish, and the guest was someone sacred in his home. I saw more characters come in over the years who were just wasting his time, and I got very upset, and he would see the distress in my face, and he said, don't be like that. It's only a life. Yet I thought to myself, what a life is being wasted here. These hours he could have been making something.
He suffered fools gladly, and at times... Here, in this case.
Well, it never surfaced in such an instance. You know, the guest would never know that he was causing any kind of unrest in Picasso or making him nervous or anything at all. He was too great a gentleman for that.
I've just turned to this double page in your book, Dave Duncan's book, David. And here's this woman, obviously affluent and powerful, talking to Picasso, listening to her. And down below, you've caught his reactions.
I never knew what happened, Studs. She came that... single day. She's dressed in a tweed suit and a fox collar, a rather metallic woman, as I saw her. Picasso's in his old sports shirt and slack pants and no tie ever, of course. And I didn't speak enough French at that time to know what they were saying. But when she left, and he was most courteous, but when she left, I kept shooting a rapid-fire camera at Picasso, and it was as though... there were a time bomb inside his head, and suddenly it exploded, and the anguish written right across his eyes and distorted his face, and he looked away almost in sorrow at the end. I don't know what happened. I've tried to find out. And
it's also very funny as I look at it. Here she's talking to him. He's listening. And you say she never knew he felt this way.
No, not at all.
And then you got the shots of himself and the grimace and suddenly his face. And what am I doing?
Yeah,
what did
I
do?
That's right.
This also, we have to think of... oh, you described something very beautiful. You mentioned California, where he lived.
Yes.
The moving from there. There's also something very wistful and poignant about this as the stuff is being packed
well,
up.
Well, in doing my homework on Picasso, I learned that when he made his famous moves from one studio to the other, it was a fact recorded throughout all the art books. It caused great distress in his life. But no one ever been there. No journalist ever been there. Then I was there when he moved from La Californie, which is his villa in Cannes, to his new Chateau de Vauvenargues. Vauvenargues is in the area of Provence, to the west of Cannes, 150 miles to the west, back in the mountains. And it was extraordinary because as the hours passed, I knew we were moving. Picasso knew that he was moving. He didn't move at all. He sat right in the studio. He sat, and Jacqueline was waiting in the car. Lumpy, the dachshund, was in the car. The driver was in the car. Jacqueline's old sewing machine was on top of the car. All the junk, everything. A side of ham that Dominguez, the bullfighter, had given him. Flowers, an old box of candy. Interestingly enough, his mail of that morning, but not the day before, was in his hand. An old portfolio that his dealer, Carnevale, had given him. And Picasso sat and sat and sat and did nothing. I was the only person in the house with him. And suddenly, the great French windows were open, the doors were open, and I heard a whirring of wings, and all of the doves flew down from the top of the house and landed and came inside the studio as though to say goodbye. And with that, he looked up, said, okay, au revoir, and walked out the door with his hat and his shoes and his shirt, and that was it, and nothing else except his old portfolio to carry his day's mail in. And once he got to Vauvenargues, to his chateau, which is a 15th century fortress back in the mountains, and that's where Picasso was buried now, and where Jacqueline loves to live. She's there now with him now. He was absolutely jubilant. He was transformed. The move had been made. His new life would start, and on he went to another empty house, and he started all over again.
Before we take a slight pause with David Douglas Duncan, His book, Goodbye Picasso, the beautiful one that Grasset and Dunlap have just published, it's available. It's both your own thoughts, reflections, his letters, your thoughts, your photographs, and a great many of his paintings. What you just said, also as though it were a new play, always beginnings, never endings, in the sense also of him. There was, again, we come to the river, don't we? We come to the river, we come to the flow, yeah. We come to continuity, as though... But he came to a new place, new challenges. It begins again on a new level each time.
It's a funny thing, though. He didn't plan for the future. He was a man of the moment.
A man of the moment.
Yes.
And yet the future was in the present.
Yes.
Let's take a slight pause right now. David Douglas Duncan, reflecting on the book that's put together, his third one, Picasso, Goodbye Picasso. And we'll return after this message. Resuming the conversation with David Douglas Duncan, you say you were just reminded of something.
No, I was thinking of something else. That's always the problem with Picasso. I start speaking one thing and my mind is hooked into another thought altogether, of these moves and the... You know, his concern many times was not even for himself. It was for Jacqueline and for Lumpy. Jacqueline, his companion at that time, 1959. They were married a couple of years later. And maybe that's what somehow I could never really pin down, was his immense concern for others, which got him into trouble, because he would let these other people come into his home and waste his time. He would let me come into his home and waste his time. You know, God, by what right did I have to stay there for so many months, which became years, firing a camera at this one man trying to do his thing in life? You know, I thought about it so much after that. And I said, why? And I've never answered the question for myself.
Yeah.
He didn't care. He wasn't trying to create an image of himself for posterity, that's for sure. He was giving, as I've thought about it, he was giving me something of himself that nobody else could make as a gift except Pablo Picasso to Dave Duncan, period. You know?
You know, just as here's this guy, there's so many dimensions to him as a person, as this man, as this host, was so gracious to, even though it took away from that breathing of his working. Yet here you have a sequence in which he's got the cigarette. He's just casually doing something. Perhaps you should read that, because this is an example of his protean quality, what he could do with plates, just as he casually did.
I'm a very bad reader.
I'll read Duncan's comments here. One dull, rainy afternoon, a few days after the Easter Corrida in Arles, Picasso sat alone at the dinner table which had so often served as a studio accessory, and in 3 hours painted 27 aquatint copper plates, the entire pageant of a Spanish bullfight. His face rarely changed. A long, dead cigarette jutted from clamped jaws as unblinking eyes, and perhaps that word unblinking for the eyes might be worth reflecting on too, Dave, as unblinking eyes measured the lunging horns of each bull. Pablo Picasso, Matador, was in the arena again. A week later, while etching the same series again at the dinner table, he resembled a medieval monk, a master draftsman penning an unhurried letter, lyric words flowing across dark parchment, only there was no scroll or letter. There were toreros and picadores and
Banderilleros,
rearing horses and swirling capes, composed with almost prehistoric purity, akin to the Altamira cavern paintings of his homeland, visited only in dreams while in self-imposed exile. In that one sequence alone, we have this incredible energy and creativity.
Yeah.
Casually, seemingly casually done.
We'd been to the bullfight 3 days before in Arles, and it was... the Monday after Easter. Pardon me. And for the next two or three days, it rained in the south of France, and he was in a foul mood. He stayed up in his bedroom most of the time. He didn't do a darn thing. And suddenly he started, right after lunch one day, and he began to paint these copper plates, and I was watching right over his shoulder. It was the greatest display of tactile versatility I've ever seen in my life. I've seen some pretty good workmen at work, really good ones. There was no retracing, no rubbing out. I simply saw, created on copper plates, the bulls and the matadors and the whole thing, the capes and the horses rolling in across the plaza. And the fight, and the variation of the fight. And there's one shot's not in there. He painted a situation. When I say he didn't change, it's not true. He did change one. He painted a matador making a pass at a bull, and he stopped and painted out. He said he made a mistake. The matador made a mistake, and the next plate had him gored. He made a mistake. He'd created a situation which only had to result in the goring of the matador. And Picasso corrected the mistake of the matador. Yeah, he didn't view it as his own mistake. He viewed it as the matador's mistake.
He saw the actuality.
God, totally.
You just said something that reminded me of something else entirely different and yet connected. You said about Picasso, almost whole it came out of him. Maestro Joseph Cripps, the conductor, Viennese conductor who loved Mozart, said Mozart was that way. The stuff would just, again, flow, kind of, but come out whole. And suddenly I realized the two guys, Picasso and Mozart, this common denominator of these two geniuses.
Both starting very young, the protege. Oh, sure.
Both started very young, too.
Sure.
But not, is this your impression, too, as you've known them, too? The stuff would not come out in pieces, but as a whole.
Up to a point. You know, when he painted in the final years of his life, he created canvases that have caused some critics to be quite contemptuous of the quality of the work. But I think that they view these canvases out of context. They're looking at the work of a man who was in his late 80s and 90. Matisse was much the same. Braque was much the same. They were in a great hurry. Time was running out on all of them. Chagall is painting like that now. His canvases of today don't resemble those that he painted 40 years ago. Sheer oil on canvas. They're not the same. One can go through Picasso's work of the last 10 years and find one masterpiece by any standard of comparison after another.